Welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. Hi! Set on election night 1979, Sus is screenwriter Barry Keefe's return to the big screen 30 years after the success of The Long Good Friday. He tells us why it's taken so long. Rising star Riz Ahmed talks about his work with satirist Chris Morris on Four Lions. Zan Brooks and I review some of the week's releases. John Cusack is in a hot tub time machine and Freddy Krueger's back on Elm Street. And we go back to 1990, to Italia 90 no less, for the football doc One Night in Turin. It's saltier than Gazza's tears. It's Film Weekly. As the colours fade away from the
dusky sunset, we roll the dark... Liquid peroxide.
3 years of stockpiling.
How'd you get it all?
A wholesale shop down the road.
What, all from the same shop?
Yeah.
You mug, you'll get us nicked.
No. I use different voices every time I go in.
Different what? Different voices?
Different voices.
Show me.
What?
Show me the voices, come on.
And one of them's... Well, it's my voice.
Right.
Can I have 12 bottles of bleach,
yeah,
please?
Yeah, I know what that sounds like. Give me another one.
IRA voice.
IRA voice? They're terrorist vessel. What do you want to do a terrorist voice? You'll get us nicked.
Well, I'll be disguised then, won't I?
Yeah, but as a terrorist.
A scene from Chris Morris's Four Lions, which tells the tale of a secret cell of British-born Muslim extremists and their hapless attempts to create havoc at the London Marathon with bombs, fury and furry animal suits. The central performance in the film is by Riz Ahmed, whose starring role in British indie hit Shifty and his leading role in the TV film The Road to Guantanamo and the series Brits has marked him as a talent to watch. I'm delighted to say he's on the phone now. Welcome to Film Weekly, Riz.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Congratulations on your performance in Four Lions. But, and I say that kind of guardedly because it's kind of a dangerous performance, it seems to me, because you're so charismatic, you're so lovable, you'll play this family man, and yet you want to blow yourself up, you want to blow people up. It's a kind of a strange comic territory.
Yeah, I guess, but I think the it's taken as given that the things that make the character maybe likeable and kind of guy you can relate to isn't the fact that he wants to blow himself up, it's everything else. And I think maybe all the other sides to these people, you know, the kind of the moments of farce and the moments of kind of family tenderness and the moments of kind of friendship rivalry and nonsense with their kind of groups of friends, those are the sides that we don't see, and I think it's those things that kind of make you relate to the character, not the fact that he's planning a terrorist attack.
But were you worried about humanising people who, you know, are suicide bombers, people who many people are terrified of and demonise?
You can only humanise people that are human. I mean, people do things that are right and people do things that are wrong, and that doesn't make them any more or less human.
Yeah, no, totally. Your job as an actor is to find the humanity in a role anyway, I'd have thought, and I think you do that beautifully here. Did you know with Chris Morris what you were getting yourself into? Did he explain what he was trying to do with the comedy? Because, you know, he won't explain to us, the media. Does he explain to his cast?
I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure that I can really explain it, but I do know that when I saw the film, I left with a quite unique feeling. It was quite a visceral response I'd had. I felt moved, but I felt slightly disorientated, but I was also still tingling from kind of laughing so hard. And hopefully it's that same kind of confused mix of complex feelings that people will leave with when they go and see the film. But I'm not sure that you could kind of boil it down to a soundbite. I think that maybe Chris is a bit too clever for that.
Yeah.
In his writing and the way he puts things together. But I do know that kind of one of the main things he wants to do is to make people laugh.
Yeah, well, I certainly laughed. I kept asking myself, should I be laughing? Why am I laughing? Is it funny? But that's exactly what he does. Now, I know Chris has made sort of much, and he's pretty wise to do so, sort of say, well, he researched this area and he worked with a lot of communities doing the research about this. He doesn't want to offend the communities as such. And there's yourself, Riz, there's Asha Ali, Kayvan Novak, Adil Akhtar. Did he talk to you about your involvement as well? Did you actors have to be sort of wary in terms of your families and the communities that you're from, and telling them that you're kind of doing a satire on some of these people?
No, I mean, you might not believe me, but I mean, wariness and fear hasn't really been something that's entered into the heads of anyone who's been involved in this, I think. And that's because we've seen the script and we know what the kind of drive of the film is and we know what the tone of the film is. And the source of the comedy, and this, I can't really emphasize this enough, isn't suicide bombing. The source of the comedy isn't terrorism. The source of the comedy are the terrorists themselves, it's the characters themselves. It's their group dynamic. It's, you know, getting a bunch of guys together. I think Chris put it in the same way that, you know, terrorism cell would inevitably have the same group dynamic as a stag party or, a football team.
Yeah.
Because it's a bunch of guys. You get a bunch of guys together in a room to try and organise anything. There will be rivalry, there will be testosterone, and there will be farce.
Uselessness.
Exactly.
It is very, very funny. Anyone that's seen the clips, that even the trailer for the film, and indeed anyone who watches the climax of the film, will see you running in what suit are you in? Honey Monster suit you're in. you do a very, very strange run as you're running in that. can you tell me about getting into that character?
Well, playing the Honey Monster was, it was method for months. Getting into that. I should confess, and this wasn't a prima donna moment by me, but a lot of when the Honey Monster is running through the London Marathon isn't me. It's the producer, Mark Herbert, from Warp Films. That's because I wasn't available those days, and they decided randomly to start shooting running scenes those days. So thanks a lot, Mark. Cheers.
That was him doing the hunch. Oh, he gets your gait just right.
Thank you. Yeah, well, they have to do this thing called smooth running, but I won't explain too much. I'll let people go and see the film.
Yeah, some of that's volatile stuff. But at this point in your career, I mean, you played, you were in The Road to Guantanamo. You sort of can't escape the fact that you're being cast as an Asian. You were in Brits as well on the telly. And is it, it seems that our justifiable preoccupation with terrorism and political schisms going on at the moment, they're sort of helping young Asian British actors get parts. Unfortunately, they seem to be those parts, you're going to be cast as an Asian. Is there a way you can break out of those moulds?
Well, I think it's only an unfortunate thing if the portrayals and the writing and the characters themselves are two-dimensional and they're stereotypical. And if they're not, then as you said, if you've got some meaty films being made or some funny films being made and there's an opportunity for more diversity on the screen, then I think that can only be a great opportunity for up-and-coming actors to grab those opportunities with both hands.
Where can we see you next, Riz? What are you going to be doing?
Well, next up, actually, I've got this album coming out later on this year, and it's slightly insane and hard to explain, but I've got this kind of interactive, immersive, theatrical live gig concept thing, and that's like we did a test drive for it at Sadler's Wells at the end of November. Next up is going to be taking over Fabric on the 17th of June.
Brilliant.
So I'm going to be doing that and touring that, and acting wise I might be doing something with Taha Rahim later on in the year, which would be great.
Wow.
I loved him in Prophet. So
absolutely. I just saw a clip of him in Kevin MacDonald's Eagle of the Ninth as well, in which he plays a Celtic warrior all dressed in green, and he looks he's amazing in that as well. Getting the two of you together would be brilliant. And if you can rap with him, even better as well. The multi-talented Riz Ahmed, lovely to speak to you. Good luck at Fabric on June the 17th. If I can get down there, I will.
Thanks a lot.
Cheers, mate.
Cheers, man.
And Four Lions is on release across the United Kingdom from May the 7th. We move smoothly from terrorism to criticism, and I'm joined now by Guardian film critic at large, Zan Brooks. Welcome back, Zan.
Thank you, Jason.
This week we're going to be looking at Four Lions, from which we've just heard from Riz Ahmed. We'll also look at A Nightmare on Elm Street, and let's go into the hot tub time machine, you and I, Zan. But first, let's look at Four Lions. It is the kind of the movie of the week in terms of its controversy, in terms of its publicity. You interviewed Chris Morris himself, the director. What did you make of the film itself?
I thought the film was very good. It slightly confounded my expectations, I think, which made it take a little while for it to kind of hit home to me. Because
isn't
obviously,
that what Chris Morris does?
Well, it is, and that's probably all to the good. But of course, we know him as this, I guess, sort of genius media satirist. He's brilliant at exposing the semiotics of newspeak, the kind of ridiculous misrepresentations of the media. And this is he's going a very different route. And I think my natural thing would be for him to expose the media hysteria around terrorism as opposed to taking us inside a kind of would-be terrorist cell and playing it as, I guess, a sitcom.
Yeah, it is. It's a farce. It's a comedy. Mm. There's a lot of levels of laughter on here because there is the satire, I think, because it is Chris Morris. There are the police are hapless. The terrorists are hapless. I mean, basically, people are hapless in this. And some of the jokes are kind of quite farcical. They're kind of at the expense of dim-wittedness, which I thought was a little bit cheap sometimes. But yet, I laughed. In fact, I kept wondering why I'm laughing. In fact, that was the main thing about Four Lions, is I kept thinking, should I be laughing? Am I laughing? Why am I laughing?
The more I thought about it, the more I thought it is a sort of deceptively radical film, because what he's saying that he's trying to do is to do for terrorists what Dad's army did for the Home Guard.
Yeah.
Now, that's a kind of dangerous thing to do.
He said that to you, didn't he? Yeah,
because you're kind of humanising them. You're actually making you sympathise with these people who want to blow themselves up and take out as many people as they possibly can.
Yes, because Dad's army, they weren't going to do that.
They weren't going to do that.
They were just trying to defend us from Mr. Hitler.
Exactly. And so that is quite a bold thing to do. And yet it's couched in these very domestic, gentle, almost sort of mild confines. And the first half of the film, I was watching it thinking, this is quite sort of broad and domestic, really. It doesn't seem to really be building to anything. And then about halfway through, one of the lead characters is running along with some homemade explosives, trips over a wall and blows himself up. And after that, you kind of think, oh, I can see where this film's going now. And it does pull the rug out from under you.
That clip, I saw it in a crowded room with lots of people kind of in a preview scenario for film 4 the other night. And they laughed. They saw this bloke blowing himself
well,
up.
Yeah.
And they laughed. And I turned around to them and said, actually, in the film, that's not funny. And it isn't funny, except it looks funny in a clip. But I think the setup is that, oh my God, that's suddenly quite...
That's a character that we've got to know.
Yeah.
And who's suddenly gone.
But I presume that happens with hapless would-be bombers.
I'm sure it does.
Didn't Faisal in New York just the other night get the wrong kind of fertiliser?
The wrong kind of fertiliser. And then you've got, you know, Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, who was caught trying to kind of strike matches to the soles of his shoes on a plane to New York. You know, I think the evidence suggests that far from being these sort of nightmarish bogeymen, all-powerful, you know, fanatics, these people, by and large, are a little ill-educated, a little misguided, and a little bit incompetent.
But one day, Zan, they won't be. Is that not going to be a dangerous
thing?
Well,
this is what's dangerous about the film, and that is maybe what it's trying to say. It's perhaps a corrective to the media hysteria surrounding terrorism. But at the same time, I don't think it entirely shies away from it. And I think, crucially, the final 20 minutes of this film are properly disturbing and properly funny in the most blackly comic way possible.
But they're also surreal as well, because you've got people running in the London Marathon. The clips are there for all to see. I mean, there are people dressed up as Wookiees and sugar puff
monsters
and chickens.
Yeah, and you've got, like, you know, what might strike some as a sort of dubious reference to Jean-Charles de Menezes' shooting with the sort of incompetent police marksman who can't tell a Wookiee from a honey monster.
I think a brilliant performance from Riz Ahmed.
Yeah.
Because he's attractive, he's charismatic, his family are loving. Why on earth does this man want to blow himself up? And why are his family behind it?
Yeah, well, it touches on all of those issues. It doesn't go into all of these issues. It's not a film that is a great psychological portrait. He is openly poking fun at these people. And again, a problem that some people might have with this film is the spectre of this middle-class white guy and two other middle-class white guys, Jesse Armstrong and Sam Bain, his co-writers, poking fun at British Asians in a North country with Hovis accents,
yeah,
who are stupid.
Yeah, I know. It's very dangerous. And I didn't know whether to laugh at all, except they kept doing it. And the repetition was quite funny. I do think there's a brilliant comic performance in there from Nigel Lindsay. You must just not leave before we mention that, which I think is one of the great... It's kind of like as Malcolm Tucker is a brilliant creation, the white Muslim, the radical white Muslim.
Yeah, well, I think this is based on you know, Chris Morris did a lot of research on this film. And it seems to me that the character of Barry, played by Nigel Lindsay, is based on several true life cases, one of which was apparently a kind of BNP hard man who read the Quran in order to have weaponry to use against Islamic extremisms and sort of accidentally converted himself. And it is a great comic emblem of our time, I think.
Absolutely. That's Four Lines by Chris Morris. And we're going to move over to Elm Street now for a little bit of a nightmare. Characters created by Wes Craven back over 25 years ago. Let's go hear from Jesse, who's played by Thomas Decker. He's going to visit Chris, and they both find out they're having the same dream about a bloke called Freddy.
Please tell me what's been going on.
Well, every time I dream, I always seen this man. And he's burned and melted. And he's always trying to attack me with these knives.
On his fingers.
What? Oh my God. We're having the same dream.
Chris, it's not possible.
It is possible.
It's just a dream, all right?
Shh. 1, 2, Freddy's coming for you, Zan. Did he get you?
He did get me. In a weird way, I think he got me perhaps more than he got me back in 1984, yeah. whenever it was that the first film came out, which I remember seeing on an old VHS cassette when I was probably about 16. Don't think I've seen since.
No, I haven't seen it since either.
And do you know, I don't remember being that impressed by
it. I hated it. I remember people liking it. I didn't like that sort of thing.
And then the franchise, I think, then became very kind of wacky, didn't it? It was Robert Englund playing Freddy Krueger, and it became sort of very postmodern and jokey, and he was like this kind of comic killer. Whereas this, even though ostensibly I think it's pretty much, drawing coloured by numbers version of the original film, I think it kind of boils it down to the bare essentials.
There's a much more kind of psychological kind of aspect to it. I think from what
do you
I
think?
Remember,
I'm not sure it's necessarily psychological.
Really?
I don't know.
These kids are haunted by, let's face it, having been hunted by a paedophile.
Yes.
In school when they were 4 or 5 years old.
Yeah.
Has that been the premise for the whole?
I think
of
so.
The,
yeah.
The,
yeah.
The Nightmare on Elm
I think it has.
Genre?
Yeah. Yeah.
They kind of stopped kind of doing Freddy as a paedophile, didn't they?
I think they did. He became sort of lovable rogue.
Yeah. How did that happen? Because I mean, Jackie Earl Haley, who plays him, brings him right back into the kind of
he's
the,
very good,
creepy kind of, isn't he?
You know,
very good,
the
yeah.
danger of with poor Jackie Earl Haley is that he may become typecast in this kind of role. He played it in Little Children
yeah,
a couple
again,
of years ago
an
and is brilliant in that as the child abuser. And here he is properly scary, I think, as Freddy Krueger. He's darker, just more genuinely disturbing, I think.
Yeah, I thought this was rather good, actually.
I was surprised.
I don't
by
like
this
sort
film.
Of thing, but this one I liked.
No, and it's a debut director, I think, Samuel Bayer, who's done sort of commercial stuff. But he obviously knows his slasher movies and, you know, really rifles through the whole bag of tricks and keeps the shocks coming. Conjures up that sort of terrible, woozy, insomniac atmosphere where the kids are sort of popping pills to try and stay awake and they keep sort of dozing off.
I thought this was a great
good
antidote to Twilight as well. You know, these teens are kind of ADD, they're kind of, you know, they're drugged, they're medicated, yeah. they're kind of troubled. And there were some good bits, there's kind of references to Poltergeist. I see there was one of the girls goes mental all over this. And a very good performance by the girl who played Nancy, Rooney Mara. I've never seen
yeah,
her
she
before.
Was very good in
excellent.
It. Yeah, but you can always, you know, you can always tell the ones that you put your money on to survive. They're never the sort of the jocks, are they?
No, or the blondes and the
yeah,
jocks. They
they're gone.
It.
It's the ones who say, I've never really quite fitted in school.
yeah,
they might make it through.
The artists listening to indie bands on their iPods. Freddy Krueger, beware those kind of girls. Dan, let's also go back to 1986, I think, in Hot Tub Time Machine. Step in to my foaming bubble bath, if you will. The Hot Tub Repairman is coming. He's played by Chevy Chase. He appears to our guys, John Cusack in particular, and reveals to them that this is a special model.
I thought maybe I could, you know, pull apart from one of the other tubs. But it turns out this is a very special model that you have here. You got to be very careful. I tell you, one little thing is changed, the whole system can go haywire. Do you understand what I'm saying? The whole system can go haywire if you change one little thing.
We're in a ski resort. Guys revisiting their past. Arrested Development, I suppose, writ large here, Zan. But in the Dayglow ski wear, did you find some laughter?
I kind of did. There's a weird little subgenre of these sort of 80s revival movies going on. I'm thinking of sort of Adventureland last year, and this is the most sort of shameless and naked one of them all, isn't it? And I guess it's John Cusack who produced it as well as acts in it. Sort of wryly referencing his own early years in those sort of Brat Pack.
The guy that plays
films.
Him as a younger guy, he looks like the John Cusack
does.
Something wild.
Yeah,
he
does.
It really is.
Yeah. And, you know, so this is, you know, the most high concept you can possibly get, I guess. I mean, it makes no bones about it and actually has one of the characters staring into the screen saying it must be a hot tub time machine.
It's rather one of the funniest lines of the thing. It is kind of blatant, isn't it, that you know, the Hollywood executives and John Cusack himself, who did it in Gross Point Blank, kind of did the high school reunion movie.
Yeah.
He is kind of mining this kind of world, but he obviously knows that there's a kind of rich audience for it, that people want to kind of relive their 80s dreams, and also the current audience want to kind of look back on the 80s in the
yeah,
way
well, it's a sort of it's studio triangulation, isn't it, because you've got people like us who were teenagers in the 80s, but then you've got perhaps, you know, genuine teenagers and people in their 20s who just want a kind of good hangover style buddy movie to go and see,
yeah, always set in amid terrible fashions that they can sort of laugh
yeah
at.
So it's got the, you know, it's got the lycra and it's got the big hair and the pounding synthesizer sort of score going on.
A lot of terrible music, which I'm not playing. A lot of terrible music
and cameos from the ghosts of the 80s, like Chevy Chase as the sort of hot tub repairman and Crispin Glover as the one-armed bellboy at this sort of dilapidated ski resort.
Yeah, which was kind of, there's references to The Shining, of course, therein. And there's also, I mean, there's references to, it kind of reminded me of Groundhog Day, which is set in a kind of snowy ski resort kind of area. And they do sort of play with time a bit. There's the classic
time travel genre thing of you know, do you try and repeat the past for fear of if you make one little change you're going to throw everything out of whack, or do you try and deliberately set out to change it to get yourself in a better position back in the future?
Yeah, what would you do?
I think I'd change absolutely everything.
You would have invented the iPod there and then.
I don't know. I just would just change absolutely everything. And I'd probably still be sitting here talking to you today.
You think they see that's the thing.
That's the worrying thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Just a quick warning to people, it is quite a vulgar movie as well, actually.
It's a very vulgar movie.
Which I quite like.
It's broad and tasteless. But it's kind of amiable too. I mean, it's very sloppy, but it's knowingly sloppy. It's having fun with the kind of idiocy of it all.
Yeah, absolutely. And why should we not enjoy it alongside them? Hot Tub Time Machine, Zan, thanks for getting in this week. Do enjoy the bubble. That is a bubble, is it?
That is my bubble.
I haven't even turned the
my
machine
own
on yet.
My personal bubble.
Zan, that's disgusting. Get out. My thanks to Zan Brooks there. And next week, the Guardian film decamps to Cannes sur la croisette, mes chers amis. Oh, 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 oh. So keep your finger on the cinematic pulse on guardian.co.uk/film. On the cusp of a changing government as we are this week, what better time to release a film which marks the dawn of the Thatcher era in 1979? Set on election night in 1979, Sus is released this week. It's the story of Delroy, a young black Londoner played brilliantly by Clint Dyer, arrested using the much-abused Sus laws and caught up in the violent and racist machinations of Detective Khan, played by Ralph Brown, and his sidekick, Wilby, played by Rafe Spall.
It seems like right now I can't walk down a roadway, a bus stop, or go for a drink without getting picked up by cops.
Maybe it's your personality.
If you don't mind me saying...
What's that?
I mean, confidentially, like.
Your secrets are safe with me.
I mean, I wouldn't want you to think I was complaining.
I can see you're not that sort of man.
They like to talk to me more than I like to talk to them. They even make up little lies to get my attention.
Yes.
Sus.
Oh.
Suspicion of this, suspicion of that.
I've heard of it.
The film is directed by Robert Heath, but the screenplay is by one of the UK's most gifted, if rarely seen, screenwriters. Except I'm delighted to say he's the man who wrote The Long Good Friday as well. Barry Keefe joins me at Film Weekly. Welcome, Barry.
Thank you.
How lovely to see you. You've just come from Leicester, where the play of Sus is kicking off a tour as well at the same time. Was that sort of serendipity, or was that sort of by design that the film version is out and the play is touring again?
There's also something else this week, is an election. And that is, of course, an extraordinary coincidence that the play and the film should happen to be opening in this week.
Because you can't have planned that. You must have taken that to get that going. Must have, well, you didn't kind of nudge Gordon Brown, as they call it, for the
No, Gordon, we tried to bribe him to do it to fit our schedule, but he wasn't taking it.
Because he's like 3 days out, isn't he?
Yes, quite inconvenient, yes.
I suppose that all means that really that the relevance of your play still maintains and is coming around again.
I find this so extraordinary. I wrote the play 31 years ago. At the time, one critic said instant political theatre. The implication was like a Kleenex throwaway theatre. I'm shocked and rather saddened that the play still has a resonance today. The Sus Law, it was played a part in the campaign to get rid of the Sus Laws in 79, which were repealed in 1982, I think, under Thatcher, ironically. But now, of course, Section 44 of the Terrorism Act of 2000, the stop and search. If you're black, or Muslim, or Asian, and you go out in the streets, you're now 7 times more likely to be pulled in than ever you were under the old Sus Laws. So it's a horrible, the vibrations of it, even more than when I wrote the damn thing.
For people who don't remember the Sus Laws, can you just briefly say what they were? I mean, your play is entitled Sus, and it was, you know, at the time, everyone knew, used to know that word. It was common parlance. People, kids in the playground used to say, you're sus, I remember. Can you just explain what that that actually meant?
Literally, it was suspect under suspicion. It was a law brought in during the fear of Napoleon invading England, the height of the British Navy. And it was to raise a navy so the law enforcement officers could pick up guys on the street without any, just on suspicion that they might commit a crime. There didn't have to be any crime, any evidence or any witnesses. That law, like so many laws in England, was never, ever repealed until recently. So the police were able to use it to just pick up anyone. It's for others to say, but I have a terrible suspicion that perhaps stop and search is not all, everyone that's pulled in for that is a potential terrorist.
Yeah, absolutely. At the time when you wrote the play, it was intended as a play. How come it took 30 years for it to become a film? What was the prime movement in you adapting it for the cinema?
And there's been over the years lots and lots of interest in it from television companies, or there has been a couple of television film companies and also two film people after it. But they wanted it diluted. There was a lot of compromises would have been made. And I actually very passionate and proud of this.
In terms
piece.
Of the language or in terms of the politics?
No, in the context, the politics. So I've always resisted those. There was a time I was really broke and I was sorely tempted, but yeah. I didn't want to mess up something that I'm proud of. But it was Clint, the instigator of this film. He did it at the Young Vic last year. It was a series of accidents, actually. Bolahan, who directs it in the theatre in the current tour, he won the Gerwood Prize last year, which is an award given to a young director. And the prize is that they finance a production of a play of your choice. And he dug out Suss, which he'd admired for a long time. Clint was selected to play. Clint Dyer plays Delroy. He'd actually done it 10 years ago in a Theatre Royal production. And I was surprised him coming back to do it 10 years later. And he said, well, I was too young at the time. I didn't have children. Now he's got a couple of kids. And he feels identifies much
absolutely.
More with it.
Absolutely. Well, you feel that in his performance.
Oh, his very heartfelt performance, yeah.
How much tinkering did you have to do from making it from the stage play into the film version? How much, thinking back to your film nous, which you hadn't used for some time? I mean, The Long Good Friday was your last film script. That's a long time ago. Well, brilliant as it is.
Yeah, no, I do a film every 30 years. So I think the next one is going to be wonderful. That'd be 2025 or
it'll be in 3D.
Actually, it's not just a film of it in the theatre. It is a proper film. We didn't open it up, didn't show Delroy at home, didn't show his wife. It wanted to go for the absolute intensity. It's only just over 90 minutes, which is an ideal, very intense. It's in one place at one time. Although I think Rob was very artfully and craftily and movingly flashed in some moments of what was actually happening outside the room in the flat. Line by line, it was no rewriting at all. It is actually exactly the dialogue of the stage play.
Oh, okay. So you could just sort of say, yes, that's good, and pass it to them and say, all right, I'll go screenwriting.
Well, no, there's a lot of talk how to actually do it. And they had, and it was done on an absolute shoestring. That gives shoestrings a new whole new meaning. It was filmed in 10 days, which is amazing for a film. So that was vast chunks were shot each day.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you get the feeling it was continuous takes as well.
And it was done in chronological order, which is very unusual.
Certainly
yeah.
comes through. But I mean, we joke and say you do a film every 30 years. I mean, The Long Good Friday is, you know, that length of time has let it kind of permeate and it's become an absolute classic. I mean, it's voted, you know, usually in the 10 best British films ever, the number 5 London film ever, one of the best gangster films ever. Why 30 years until you manage to get the Suss meaning?
But I've written a couple of other films that for different reasons. I mean, I think it was Peter O'Toole, the wonderful quote. He says there's three kinds of madness. Madness, divine madness, and making films. And that palaver, yes, of course, I've been to Hollywood a couple of times and we talk about it and I've done drafts and they want changes and nothing's ever worked out. It was such a wonderful, this Suss that happened so quickly. But no, sure as hell hope it's not going to be another 30 years.
No, indeed. Well, every time, I mean, The Long Good Friday is one of the ones I go back to all the time. Even when Helen Mirren's playing the Queen, I like to go back and watch her in the Long Good Friday. She was the Queen then as well. So you were writing Suss, the play, sort of roughly the same time you were writing The Long Good Friday?
No, it was when The Long Good Friday was being shot, I was writing Suss. Yeah.
Because the politics of the two are very, I mean, obviously politics informs your work, and but these two are sort of the politics, as you say, they keep going round and round.
It's a sure coincidence. You saying that, I was thinking this myself this morning. The cop in Suss is a Thatcher man sort of gone mad, actually, which is not a million miles unadjacent to the character Harold Chand in The Long Good Friday. I obviously, this was very much in my head. I can only see it now, this distance from it. It's very hard sometimes to spot the difference between a man of the law and a man who makes his living breaking the law. The style of dress, the style of speak, the kind of looking at the angles all the time, they are incredibly similar.
Well, Barry Keefe, thank you so much for joining us here on Film Weekly. A brilliant new film, which is an old play, and a brilliant old film, which obtains to this day as one of my favourites here in the Long Good Friday. Lovely to meet you. The great Barry Keefe there. Suss goes on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 7th of May. If not, you can catch it touring on stage at a theatre near you. Check your press for details. This week we go back to 1990 for the release of a documentary One Night in Turin about that fateful night during the Italia 90 World Cup campaign when England's dream of glory was resurrected and crucified in one game.
After 2 hours of the most incredible football, no one had lost. But someone has to win. So the greatest of team games is reduced to a lottery. Five kicks each. One on one. Five kicks to score or save. And if it was still a stalemate, then someone had to take a sixth.
And I'm delighted to say, not bottling it at all on the run-up, looking me straight down the barrel with his eyes, is James Erskine in the Guardian Studios. Welcome to Film Weekly, James.
Hi, Jason.
Lovely to see you. Thanks for bringing back these memories. I think thanks. I don't really know, really. I'm crying with Gazza.
Yeah, I think one of the things we wanted to achieve was that you went on the journey with the characters and that you felt it, not from the point of view of the result per se, but actually what it meant to sort of be there and be with that character and feel what they felt like and really get inside the minds of.
I mean, I don't know about you, this was my World Cup. I mean, it's not my first, obviously, but I actually saw every single game at this World Cup. I was a student at the time, so I had nothing to do. I got caught up in the poll tax riots and then I watched every game of this World Cup. And then, and obviously, I was DJing at the time and playing a lot of Happy Mondays and Stone Roses. So basically, you've made the film that I wanted to make.
Yeah, well,
so
actually I made it for you, actually.
Thank you very much.
Especially. and that was the pitch in the first place. So
is it as dear to you as it is to me?
It's really dear to me. I mean, I was 16 when this World Cup happened, so I remember watching all the games, listening to the music. I was growing up in Manchester at the time. This was my scene, and you know, it really felt like it was like my record player. You know, the music is like my record player in 1990. You know, what was going on in my head, and also how I felt about England and about football, I think was represented within that, you know.
And the thesis of your film is that this night in Turin, the semi-final between England and Germany, changed that public perception of it. In fact, sort of Gazza cried and football changed forever in a way. It's a kind of bold thesis, and I see where you're going with it in the film. And I was interested, I was thinking, where's the film going to go? And you sort of do that in the closing credits, and that's not spoiling it for anyone who hasn't seen the film. And there's a lot of information packed into those closing credit in that future spread out after the sort of remake of England.
Yeah. I mean, I think what we wanted to really do was, rather than to tell you what happened as a series of facts, is to make something which we felt worked theatrically and worked in cinemas, which was a much more emotional journey, so that you travelled with the characters and felt what they felt. So at the beginning, you do feel like football's a pretty bad thing and we're quite rubbish. And at the end, you see that actually the whole nation is uniting, and we do. And you're feeling what Gazza's feeling, what Bobby Robson's feeling, what those people in the pubs, what Prescott's feeling when he's sat in House of Commons. That this is like this is an incredible, almost religious experience of the most watched sporting event in British history. Everybody uniting and thinking, this could be it. I mean, when does that ever happen? That happens at football matches. That happens in cinema. There's only two environments I can think of where you have a mass number of people thinking the same thing.
And willing. You got Gary Oldman to do the narration, which I thought was rather masterstroke, given that he was, you know, the iconic hooligan of our times in Alan Clarke's Brilliant the Firm movie. Presumably that was part of the decision. And is he a football fan, Gary? I never quite know where he's...
Gary is a football fan, yeah. No, it was great getting Gary on board. And you know, he responded really well to the pitch and was, you know, obviously we don't have necessarily Hollywood studio wages, but yeah, Gary was great. He really wanted to do it. He read the treatment, saw the rough cut, and was like, I want to do this because I love football. And it was a really resonant time for him, I think. But we talked a lot about Alan Clark and the firm, obviously, when we're doing it, because it's just such an incredible performance. But yeah, no, it tied into him, you know, it tied into who he was.
It's quite dispassionate, really. When I saw, oh, it's going to be by Gary Oldman, I thought he's going to get really... He's quite sort of detached from it as a narration. It's kind of very measured, if you like, and he lets the prose... I mean, there's some lovely phrases like the oafish melee and the awful one into the breach kind of stuff. It gets purple and then he kind of sits back a bit as well. Did he do it in a day? How do you get Gary Oldman to do your narration? How quickly does he?
How quickly does he do it? Well, it's very interesting because as we were trying to get him and secure him, we were like reducing the kind of time and saying, oh, we could do it in half an hour out the back, whatever, please just do it. And we got this great email back saying Gary feels like it's going to take 2 days, which is actually a long time for documentary narration. I mean, on equivalent films, you know, I'd be looking at 3 to 4 hours. So he was very generous, and we approached his narration in a different way. Rather than following to picture, we did it like a performance, and we did lots of takes, and we worked that way to get the measure across the film, because of course you're right that at times it's very dispassionate, but what we wanted to do is, when you're in the games, is you really felt a movement through it. So there's this kind of constant sort of storyteller, I suppose, we wanted to have, like, you know, like you're recounting to your 15-year-old son.
Yeah,
this great, great story.
And then you get Barry Davis's commentary. How I miss him, I thought, when I was listening to that commentary. He was always my favourite commentator. He was always castigating players for missing penalties, which, of course, we did. It's funny, isn't it, that the world changed and we remember this night, but, of course, England lose. it's kind of quite English, the fact that we love this night and we welcome them back as heroes, but they actually lost.
They did actually lose, but, you know, I suppose...
I don't think Mr. Capello would think we were heroes if we lost.
Well, I think in the context of 1990, we'd been pretty rubbish since 1966. We hadn't had any success internationally. In fact, we didn't qualify for that many World Cups.
Yeah, we had 74, we didn't there, and 78.
And the expectation was so low. The expectation when they went out there was that they were going to get, you know, like in the European Championships in 88, they were going to get tonked by the Dutch, you know, who were supposedly the masters of the universe. They were going to, you know, probably, you know, get beaten by the Irish as well and go home, you know, with their tails between their legs. And I think it was that change of expectation that really drove people. It's like people want to follow the underdogs, I think. And that's why there was such a sort of passionate association. And there was obviously the political context at the time. But yeah, no, we didn't win, but we did win it. We did win because we played the best game of football and nobody lost. Nobody lost that semi-final.
James Erskine, lovely to see you. And for One Night in Turin, I wish you the best of luck with it as you sell it around the world. And let's see if the world can get behind England. And maybe this World Cup we'll be doing One Night in Cape Town. Or is it Johannesburg?
I can't remember where the semi-final is, but we're bound to play
let's
Germany.
Do the final.
On penalties, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. We'll win this time. Show them this and the Germans will be laughing.
Well, I want it to be Fabio Capello's, you know, pre-match talk, surely.
Brilliant. With never-before-seen footage, One Night in Turin is released here in the UK on Friday the 7th of May. And no, Chris Waddle doesn't actually score in this version. What a shame. That's all for this week. The music featured in the show this week is from One Night in Turin. You've been hearing New Model Army, The Farm, The Charlatans. Oh, take me back. Ooh. Pick up a copy of The Observer for Trailer Trash this week. Of course, some few Cannes previews in there. And next week, as I say, we'll have the first of our two Cannes Film Festival specials. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.